and welcome to the Super High Yield Anesthesia Podcast, the second edition. This is your host, Scott, the anesthesia resident. Thanks for tuning in to the Super High Yield Anesthesia Podcast. This is Scott, the anesthesia resident, and today we're going to continue our adventures in pain management. And today specifically, we're going to start a two-part episode on major opioids and pain management. So this first part, we're going to spend most of our time talking about the mechanisms of opioids as well as the major opioids in pain management. We're going to kind of go through them one by one, different ones that you might encounter not only in clinical practice, but also on your boards. And as I go through these particular concepts and different opioids, I hope to highlight anything that I've seen on exams or like practice questions or anything like that, so that we can keep this as high yield for you as we can. Okay, so that's going to be part one in today's episode. And the next one, part two, will be a little bit more clinical based, using opioids in acute pain service. Most of this stuff I got from a handbook that I received during my acute pain rotation, and I'll throw in some of my my own experiences in there as well. But yeah, that's for the next episode. Today's episode is mainly on the mechanisms of opioids and the different ones that you encounter. So with all that said, let's go ahead and get started. So let's begin our discussion by talking about the mechanisms of opioids. We use it a lot, and sometimes it's easy to forget how they work. So let's go back to basics and talk about the receptors, kind of what happens when you give a patient opioids. So basically, as we kind of discussed in previous episodes, the body has a lot of opioid receptors. So we have mu, kappa, and delta receptors, opioid receptors. And this, again, is found throughout the body. And this is very important for spinal and epidural administered opioids, is they have a high concentration in dorsal horn of the spinal cord. So when you have an opioid or like an endorphin that attaches onto one of the opioid receptors, these receptors are G protein coupled. What happens afterwards is the alpha subunit exchanges GDP for GTP. And then from there, it forms an alpha GTP complex and beta gamma complex that acts upon various proteins. What happens after this is it inhibits adenyl cyclase, which decreases the intracellular CAMP, and it also acts on ion channels. So it increases the potassium channels. So you have more efflux of potassium. That way the neuron becomes hyperpolarized. So then it does not have the opportunity to perform another action potential. And then it also decreases the amount of calcium. And as you remember, calcium is very important in terms of releasing neurotransmitters. So what are the net effects of opioids? Well, as we discussed, one, it causes hyperpolarization of the cell. It causes decreased neurotransmitter release. And lastly, it decreases intracellular CAMP. And I encourage you to take a look at the show notes. I included a picture from Google to kind of depict the sequence of events when something binds an opioid receptor. But obviously, if you don't look at the show notes, I encourage you to take a look at, you know, just Google it or something like that, just so in case you need a visual to accompany the audio. Okay, lastly, before we kind of wrap up the general mechanisms, so we'll talk about the different receptors. As we mentioned earlier, there are three major types of opioid receptors, the mu, kappa, and delta. So the mu receptors, it causes the physical dependence. It's seen in opioid use. It causes the euphoria. But it's also responsible for the negative stuff, so respiratory and cardiac depression. It causes reduced GI motility, as well as sedation. by far the effects of opioids that we generally think of are likely due to the mu receptors agonism. Okay, next is kappa, and this one causes meiosis, dysphoria, and sedation. And lastly, delta opioid receptors has the antidepressant effects. All right, so that's the general mechanisms of opioids. Not too much. I didn't want to bother you with too nitty-gritty details, but that's the high-yield thing to remember about the opioids, okay? So the next part is we're going to go through each of these opioids. First off, we're going to talk about the common opioids used in the OR. I know I just said this, but I found a really cool table that kind of summarizes the different drugs. It has the echoanalgesic doses, the onset time, peak time, and duration of IV versus oral for the different opioids. So highly consider looking at the show notes because I found a really cool table, and the source for the table is in the show notes as well. So I don't own it and I don't claim responsibility. So, you know, for legal purposes, yeah. but anyways, yes. So regarding the common opioids, the main ones that we're going to talk about right now are morphine, fentanyl, hydromorphone or Dilaudid, sufentanyl, alfentanyl, remifentanyl, and meperidine. So for morphine, the mechanism for this one is mu opioid receptor agonist. The advantage of using morphine, there's a very wide variety of routes of administration. You can give it by mouth, PO, you can give it IV, you can do it in epidural, so you can use intrathecally. And so basically the sky's the limit on morphine. So if you take morphine by mouth or PO, there's different types of formulations. There's the short acting formulations. So Roxanol, morphine, MSIR, and there's longer acting formulations. These things like MS-Contin, Oramorph, SR, Cadian, and Embedda, or like the, name brands for PO morphine. Regarding the pharmacokinetics of morphine, just a quick fire bullet points here. For IV, the onset time for morphine is less than 5 minutes. The peak plasma concentration is 20 minutes, and the duration is going to be 3 to 6 hours. For PO, the onset time is 15 to 60 minutes. Peak time is 30 to 60 minutes, and duration is 3 to 6 hours. The bioavailability is 24 to 40% with repeated dosing, particularly with PO administration. So as you can see, it's relatively low bioavailability, and this is due to first-pass metabolism. As you already probably know, morphine is relatively hydrophilic. So there's a delay in transport across a blood-brain barrier, and therefore it has a slower onset of action. But thanks to its hydrophilicity, though, it has a longer analgesic effect of, again, it's around 4 to 5 hours, despite the shorter plasma half-life. When morphine is metabolized, the primary effect that we generally see is due to its parent compound. However, it does have active metabolites, morphine 3 glucuronide, or M3G, and morphine 6 glucuronide, M6G. These are actually very important to know for boards, so I would pay attention to this next section. So M3G, this lacks mu and delta receptor activity, but accounts for about 50% of the metabolites. It causes hyperalgesia, CNS irritability, causes seizures, myoclonus in animal studies. However, its true mechanism is currently unknown. And next is M6G. This one has activity on both mu and delta receptor agonists. and accounts for about 5 to 15% of metabolites. The intrinsic causes intrinsic opioid agonism, and it sustains the analgesia. So because of these metabolites, there's a certain subset of patients that you'll have would maintain caution when using morphine. First things first is patients with renal impairment. The metabolites of morphine, the things like M3G and M6G, they are excreted renally. So if, for example, a patient has ESRD and you give a lot of morphine, these metabolites could accumulate and it could cause toxicity. So you'll see things like seizure, CNS irritability, and that's something that you will see in boards. Okay, and the one that you kind of boards generally hit on the most is M6G. So definitely remember that. And of course, since the metabolites are not fully or having issues with excretion, and things like M3G still has some sort of a degree of activity, so it increases the risk for respiratory depression, encephalopathy, and myoclonus. And again, this is it's more likely in patients with renal failure. And the other patient population to be wary of is cirrhotic patients due to its reliance on hepatic metabolism. And the last thing to know about morphine is that the IV and rectal routes avoids hepatic bile transformation, so less glucuronide concentration. So that's something that you can keep in mind. But, you know, it doesn't completely reduce your risk for the things that we kind of discussed earlier. So that's for morphine. Now we're going to kind of move on to fentanyl. In general, fentanyl was actually initially formulated for surgical procedures. Quick facts about fentanyl in IV, the onset time is less than 1 minute. Peak time, based on resources, is not quite known, but it's relatively quick. And the duration is short, however, as it's only about 1 to 2 hours. This is likely due to its lipophilicity, which we will talk about in the PharmConnect section. Fentanyl can be used transdermally as well, and this is mainly for patients with opioid tolerance, so basically chronic pain patients as well as cancer pain. Just for completeness, we'll talk about a little bit what the transdermal thing looks like. So there's four layers. There's the polyester backing layer, so it's impenetrable to drug loss and moisture. There's the actual drug reservoir. So fentanyl is kind of in a gel form with hydroxyethylcellulose and ethanol. And then there's a rate control membrane, so you don't release all that drug at once. And lastly, there's the silicone adhesive. So if you wanted to know what transdermal fentanyl was or was made of or the layers of it, now you know. If not, then too bad. Now you know too. Okay, so for fentanyl, the mechanism, as for most opioids, is predominantly mu opioid receptor agonism, and there's very little affinity to kappa and delta. Regarding pharmacokinetics, as we said earlier, it's pretty lipophilic, and because of that, it has a faster onset of action compared to morphine. But it's also about 75 to 125 times as potent. Regarding metabolism, it's hepatically metabolized by CYP3A4, and its inactive metabolite is norfentanyl. It does have a high first-pass metabolism of IV, so that's probably one of the reasons why it only provides about 30 to 60 minutes of analgesia. Okay, next is hydromorphone, or more commonly known as Dilaudid, or colloquially known as vitamin D. Or for some patients, it's that drug that starts with a D, that's the only thing that works, that unlike morphine. Anyways, so in general, hydromorphone is a hydrogenated ketone analog of morphine. If you're really really curious is a DD or N demethylation, or sorry, it's a N demethylation hydrocodone. Hydromorphone can be given PO, IV, or through neuroaxial ways like epidural and intrathecal. And a nice thing is it has less adverse effects compared to morphine, though it is 5 to 7 times more potent than morphine. So some quick facts about hydromorphone IV. The onset time is usually around 15 minutes. A peak plasma levels is reached 30 to 60 minutes when given IV, and a duration of action is around 4 to 6 hours. For PO, the onset is 15 to 30 minutes. Peak is also around 30 to 60 minutes, and duration is also 4 to 6 hours. So the mechanism behind hydromorphone is that it's a mu receptor agonist. It is hydrophilic, and the analgesic effect is around 4 to 6 hours. Regarding pharmacokinetics, when given orally, the bioavailability varies tremendously, so 20 to 80%. The onset time, as we kind of discussed, 30 minutes PO, 5 minutes IV. Peak effect in 30 to 60 minutes, again, is likely due to its hydrophilicity and difficulty crossing the blood-brain barrier. Regarding metabolism, is hepatically biotransformed. So the primary metabolite is going to be hydromorphone 3 glucuronide, so H3G. So the thing about H3G is it lacks analgesic efficacy, but it is a very potent neuroexcitatory, it has potent neuroexcitatory properties. And as such, it could cause allodynia, myoclonus, and seizures. So, and lastly, hydromorphone is also renally excreted. So the metabolite produced is in small quantities. So it's actually preferred over morphine. So example, if a patient has ESRD, I'm going to kind of jump the gun here, but a common board question is something like, which opioids are avoided in patients with a chronic renal failure. So it's going to be morphine and meperidine, because those two drugs have active metabolites that accumulates because those things are renally excreted. So instead of giving morphine or meperidine for patients with chronic renal problems, you can give hydromorphone instead. Okay, next is sufentanil. To be honest, I never actually use sufentanil, nor alfentanil, which is the next one. So this is just stuff that I read and just going to report to you in terms of completeness. Okay, so in general, sufentanil is used in the operative setting, and it is more popular use in IV or neuroaxial form. And apparently sufentanil is a thiamyl analog of fentanyl. Regarding pharmacokinetics, it's highly lipophilic, has rapid onset, short duration like regular fentanyl, though it does have a smaller volume distribution as opposed to fentanyl, and it has a greater analgesic potency than fentanyl and a shorter half-life. So it's like a live fast, die young kind of drug. Metabolism, like other opioids, is CYP3A4. And the major thing to know about sufentanil that it could cause a dose-dependent relationship to skeletal muscle rigidity. Okay, next is alfentanil. And again, this is something I haven't used myself, so I don't have any particular experience with this. But in general, alfentanil is primarily used in an operative setting like sufentanil, and it can also be given IV or neuroaxial. Regarding pharmacokinetics, it is less lipophilic than fentanyl and sufentanil. It does have a smaller volume distribution, so about 25% of fentanyls. But like the two predecessors, it has a short elimination half-life, so around 70 to 111 minutes. Alfentanil also has a rapid onset of analgesia. So an IV is about 1 to 2 minutes, and epidural is 5 to 15 minutes. And again, it does have a shorter duration. So if given IV, it only lasts for about 10 to 15 minutes. For an epidural, it only lasts for 4 to 8 hours. Okay. And again, for metabolism wise, it's hepatically metabolized with CYP3A4. I'm going to continue on to remifentanil, my favorite opioid. It's like the cheat code for any sort of sick patient. Say, for example, if they have HFrEF, that's like 10%, ESRD, I don't know, heart stuff, whatever. If you use that as like your primary anesthetic and then you just like background, like maybe a little bit of prop or a little bit of gas or something, I find that you will have a very stable anesthetic. And, you know, of course it varies by patient, but remifentanil is an amazing drug. So, anyways, so in general, remifentanil is the most potent mu opioid receptor agonist and is used IV for induction and maintenance of anesthesia. Regarding pharmacokinetics, it's actually more lipophilic than fentanyl. It's a larger volume distribution. Though the thing is, it's more has more rapid distribution and metabolism. So the shorter elimination half-life is like 3 to 10 minutes. And a shorter duration of action is only 5 to 10 minutes. And because of its rapid analgesic onset, or because of this, we can use it in a lot of cases that require paralysis, but we can't really use muscle relaxants. So for example, if we're doing a spine surgery or a brain surgery, this is commonly used as part of the TEVA, right? And the thing about remifentanil is it has a very short context-sensitive half-time. Briefly, I think I talked about this during the neurosurgery, neuro procedure, neuroanesthesia episode, but context-sensitive half-time is basically the duration, how long it takes for a drug to be eliminated based on how long it's been running as an infusion. So for example, things like propofol or fentanyl or something has a longer context sensitive half-time. So the longer you run the infusion, the longer you're going to have to wait for it to be metabolized and the effects to be worn off. The beauty of remifentanil is it comes on fast and it comes off fast. So that's why it's very highly effective drug for things like spine surgeries that can go on for a long time, or even short cases where, say, example, they're doing like a total knee amputation for a sick patient. You can give this as your main anesthetic and kind of go from there. Metabolism wise, this is actually a very high yield board point. Remifentanil is degraded by tissue and plasma esterases due to its ester side chain linkage, and it's metabolized into its inactive carboxylic acid metabolite, which is then renally excreted. So the main things I'll take away from remifentanil is one, low context-sensitive half-time. Now, also one of those live fast, die young kind of opioids, and it's degraded by plasma esterases. So definitely remember that because it does come up on boards. Okay, next is meperidine, and the primary use for this is post-anesthesia shivering. The half-life is about 3 hours. And a fun fact about meperidine is that it was developed in Nazi Germany as a synthetic opioid with weak mu opioid receptor agonism. So it's been around for almost 100, no, less than 100 years or so. It is 1/10 as potent as morphine. It is slightly fast onset and a shorter duration of action compared to morphine, and at analgesic dosage. Causes less sedation and pruritus compared to morphine. though it's more effective in treating neuropathic pain compared to morphine. So the main things to be aware of regarding meparidines, like the adverse effects, is one, cardiac stuff. So it causes orthostatic or direct myocardial depression. It does have anticholinergic effects. It does have some local anesthetic properties. And then if you give it neuraxially, it causes a sensory motor sympathetic blockade. And it also has toxic metabolite accumulation. So it's metabolized into norepinephrine, which is a neurotoxin. So it causes CNS hyperactivity and seizures. And the meparidine also has a very long half-life, 12 to 16 hours. So again, high yield board fact is the main things to avoid in patients with chronic renal disease is morphine due to its accumulation of M3G and M6G, and meparidine, which has an accumulation of norepinephrine. And again, with accumulation of these things, so you have neurotoxin effects as well as the other effects like respiratory depression and all that stuff. Okay, and the last high yield thing to know about meparidine for board purposes is it could cause serotonin syndrome if a patient is on pre-existing serotonergics. So MAO inhibitors, so MAO inhibitors, SSRIs, tramadol, and methadone, since those ones have increased the concentration of serotonin, the addition of meparidine could trigger a serotonin syndrome picture. Okay, so now that we discussed the common opioids used intraoperatively in the OR, now to move on to the different opioids that are common in acute and chronic pain. And for this section, we're going to talk about oxycodone, hydrocodone, codeine, tramadol, methadone, and buprenorphine. Okay, so for oxycodone, general info about oxycodone, that it's a semi-synthetic drug. It's relatively short-acting. It does come in immediate release formulations, so oxycodone or Oxy-IR or roxycodone. And sometimes it could be formulated with acetaminophen. So it could be things like Percocet, Roxyset, Etoset, or it could be formulated with aspirin, which is called Percodan or Percodon. I don't know. It comes in abuse deterrent forms, the SR oxycodone naloxone. The brand name is Targinic extended release. So quick facts about oxycodone. It is a strictly PO medication. So this is actually one of the common ones when you're trying to convert IV to PO. The onset time is about 10 to 15 minutes. Peak plasma concentrations in 120 to 180 minutes. And has a duration of action between 4 to 6 hours. Regarding pharmacokinetics, the positives of using oxycodone is one, it technically has no ceiling dose and it has minimal side effects. So things like hallucinations, dizziness, and pruritus. It has some minimal active metabolite versus things like morphine or meparidine. It's relatively easy to titrate. It has a relatively fast onset, especially for a PO drug. And does have a short half-life, long duration of action when compared to morphine. Oxycodone has a relatively high bioavailability with 55 to 64% after first pass, and it is definitely more potent than morphine. Regarding metabolism, it is hepatically metabolized with cytochrome P450, specifically for oxycodone is 2D6. So this is the other CYP protein or CYP enzyme that's important to remember, so 2D6. So after metabolized by the liver, its oxycodone is converted to oxymorphone, which is an active metabolite with high affinity for the mu receptor. Different cautions for this one is drug interactions. So concurrent SSRIs, TCA, azoles, mycins, and neuroleptics, mainly because it interferes with cytochrome P450 enzymes. And kidneys excrete oxycodone metabolites, so be a little bit careful with the dosing. Okay, the next opioid is going to be hydrocodone. In general, hydrocodone is opium derivative. It is less potent than oxycodone. And the common products that that comes with hydrocodone, or like the brand names, are Norco. And Norco is hydrocodone and acetaminophen, and Hyset, which is the oral solution. And generally for Norcos, you would see them described prescribed in the 5 and 10 milligram dosages, so Norco 5 through 25 and Norco 10 through 25. So hydrocodone is metabolized by P450 enzymes. So hydrocodone is metabolized by CYP2D6 into hydromorphone, and then is further metabolized by 3A4 to norhydrocodone. And it's important to note that these are poor metabolizers and they risk accumulation, especially you have to be wary of certain drug interactions. Like, so for example, if patients on clarithromycin, it would lead to the accumulation of it because clarithromycin is a potent CYP3A4 inhibitor. Okay, next is codeine. In general, codeine is similar structure to morphine, but 200 times less affinity to the mu receptor. Metabolism-wise, it's also metabolized by the liver by CYP450 enzyme into morphine. And if patients who are poor metabolizers, they have a specific phenotype, they have like a defective CYP2D6, and this occurs in about 5 to 10% of patients, and it decreases the amount of morphine through metabolism. So that's why you'll see some patients that won't respond very well to codeine, and it's because they have a defective CYP2D6 enzyme. And important to note that there's an FDA black box warning for kids undergoing tonsillectomies and adenoidectomy due to patients with due to the obstructive sleep apnea or OSA. Okay, next is tramadol. So tramadol's mechanism is it's a weak mu agonist, and it also inhibits norepinephrine and serotonin reuptake. And this is from the parent compound. So this is actually a pretty high yield board point, because this is the side effects is increased serotonin or norepinephrine, right? So a common thing is like, oh yeah, a patient is taking SSRI and then they're prescribed tramadol and then develop something like fever, myoclonus, GI distress as well. And they're trying to get at increasing the risk for serotonin syndrome when prescribing tramadol with other psychotropic medications like SSRIs or something like that. So yeah, that's a very high yield board point for you to remember. Okay, so tramadol's metabolism is by CYP2D6 into the active metabolite O-desmethyltramadol, or M1, and this is the one that is the weak mu agonist. Okay, and pharmacodynamics-wise, tramadol has 6,000 times less affinity for mu receptors than morphine, and M1, the metabolite, has 300 times greater affinity for mu receptors than the parent drug. So excretion mostly relies on renal excretion. So in normal kidneys, the maximum dose is going to be 400 milligrams. So next is going to be methadone. So the name actually comes from its chemical structure. So I'm going to butcher this one, but It's 6-dimethylamino, 4,4-diphenyl-13-heptanone. So if you can use your imagination, methadone comes from that chemical formula. So as you might have guessed, this is methadone is a synthetic drug. So quick facts about methadone. If given through IV, the onset is 10 to 30 minutes. Peak onset is 4 to 60 minutes, and the duration is 4 to 8 hours. If given by mouth, the onset is going to be 30 to 60 minutes. The peak is going to be 30 to 60 minutes as well. And the duration is going to be 4 to 8 hours. Mechanism-wise, methadone is a mu opioid agonist. It is, but then it has less affinity than morphine. And the positive side for this, it has less side effects. It's also important to note that methadone is also a NMDA receptor antagonist, so it has two sites of action to relieve pain. So, mu opioid agonist and NMDA receptor antagonist. Okay, so pharmacokinetic wise, the half-life is relatively long, but so 6 to 150 hours, depending on the person. Because it's highly lipophilic and has extensive tissue distribution, and because of this, accumulation of methadone usually happens if there's repeated dosing. So that's why titration methadone is going to take a really long time. So it occurs in the order of days to weeks to get the right spot. Okay, so bioavailability, if given orally, is about 80%. Sublingually, it's going to be 34 to 75%. For methadone, there's no known active metabolites. So one thing that is difficult in the acute pain service when giving methadone, or let's say, for example, a patient was on methadone and you're trying to convert it to, say, morphine or something, it's not as straightforward as converting from like morphine to Dilaudid or like morphine to hydrocodone or vice versa. There's no linear conversion between regular opioids and methadone. So what you end up doing is you convert it in terms of a ratio. So for example, in the show notes, there's a table between the amount of opioids received in a day versus the conversion. But basically, say, for example, a patient takes oral morphine, like 100 to 300 milligrams per day. The ratio of milligrams of oral morphine to oral methadone is going to be 1 to 8. And you're going to convert the dosage that way with that ratio. So again, it's not as straightforward as conversion between, say, morphine and Dilaudid. So you're going to have to consult the table and ratios if you're trying to start methadone or you're trying to convert methadone to a different opioid. Okay, so if that didn't make sense, I'll kind of go through the process in order here. And again, I highly encourage you to take a look at the show notes just so you can have the table in front of you. But basically, so for example, if you're trying to convert from the regular opioids to methadone, the first step is you're going to convert all the opioids into its PO equivalents. And then from there, you calculate the total daily dose of MMEs to determine the ratio. And then from there, to determine the ratio to use, and from there you can calculate the methadone dose. Basically, after that, you're going to reduce the calculated oral methadone by 30 to 50% due to cross-reactivity. And basically from there, you're going to divide the daily dose by 3 because the methadone is given every 8 hours. Okay. Things to be wary about when giving methadone is one, and this is actually a very high yield board point, is QTC prolongation. So that's why any patient that's started on methadone is recommended to have a baseline EKG. But we'll kind of get there in a second. So QTC prolongation occurs particularly when given in this IV solution, mainly due to its preservative chlorobutanol. Okay. be wary to prescribing methadone if you have a patient that's getting any sort of antipsychotics, so haloperidol, quetiapine, olanzapine, chlorpromazine, and amitriptyline. If patients are on any of those, just be wary of starting methadone because of the QTC prolongation. Okay, regarding chronic pain guidelines, as we kind of said earlier, you want to get a baseline EKG. And if you're starting another, like a dosage change, say, for example, you're increasing the dose, it's probably a good idea to get another EKG and a follow-up EKG after about 2 to 4 weeks after increasing the dosage. And again, due to its risk for accumulation as well as the long titration period and the long half-life, it's recommended to not increase the dosage by more than 10 milligrams every 5 to 10 days. Okay, other than QTC prolongation, you're also worried about drug interactions. So in CYP450 enzyme inhibitors, specifically 3A4 inhibitors, you're going to have increased levels of the methadone cause accumulation. So for example, examples of CYP3A4 inhibitors is going to be ciprofloxacin, isoniazid, diazepam, clonazepam, cimetidine, verapamil, diltiazem, and nefazodone. And the opposite end, you have to be wary of any CYP3A4 inducers, which would rapidly metabolize the methadone and therefore decrease the level of methadone. Some examples of this is going to be carbamazepine, nevirapine, nefivinavir, I think that's the HIV drug, phenytoin, phenobarbital, and rifampin. And there's a pretty interesting use. My institution, we don't really, or I guess, sorry, moving on to like just random stuff about methadone. My institution, we generally do not use methadone for spine surgeries or anything like that, but I know other institutions, they do as part of their spine protocol, so that's pretty cool. And there's an ACRAC episode actually speaking about methadone. It was this gentleman who's basically a champion of it, using it in most cases, and I highly recommend you take a look at that or take a listen of that. Okay, the last opioid we're going to cover in this episode is buprenorphine. General facts about buprenorphine is that it's a semi-synthetic opioid. It's a derivative of thebaine. I actually have no idea what that is. Let's take a look. Thebaine, I guess it's just an opiate alkaloid. That does not help me. But anyways, and it was developed as an alternative to methadone maintenance. So buprenorphine is available in sublingual, buccal, and transdermal and IV forms. The sublingual buccal formulations, so things like Suboxone, contains naloxone, a mu opioid receptor antagonist, and this is to prevent abuse, and that's why it's one of the good drug to use for treatment of opioid dependence. So the interesting thing about Suboxone is that the ratio of buprenorphine to naloxone is 4:1. So basically, when you ingest this medication, a naloxone isn't active when it's given through the GI tract. But if you, say, for example, you dissolve it and try to inject it as an IV form, you're actually going to cause the naloxone to be active, and from there, it negates the mu opioid activity of buprenorphine. So it kind of negates it. So it's an interesting drug to kind of prevent any abuse. Okay, so indications for buprenorphine are things like opioid dependency with some sort of contraindication to methadone, no availability to methadone or treatment failure with methadone, and if a patient has a brief history of opioid tolerance and lower requirements for opioid agonists. So basically, it's the alternative to methadone. And a nice thing is you don't really have to do the EKGs and whatnot and have the close monitoring at the methadone clinic. I believe we'll be talking about that in a future episode. So that's pretty much it in terms of the indications of buprenorphine. Quick facts about buprenorphine. IV, if given IV, the onset is about 15 minutes. The peak onset is 60 minutes, and the duration is 48 hours. For if given PO, the onset is also 15 minutes. The peak onset is 40 to 210 minutes, and the duration is unknown, at least in my source. Regarding the mechanism of buprenorphine, it's a mu receptor partial agonist. So definitely remember that for boards. It acts on a CNS. There's a plateau effect on analgesia at higher doses, and it also has a ceiling effect on respiratory depression. So that's a very high yield kind of characteristic of buprenorphine, so that you don't have the respiratory depression that can be seen with other opioids. So other than being a mu receptor partial agonist, it's a weak kappa antagonist and a weak delta agonist. Regarding pharmacokinetics, in terms of absorption, if given orally, it has poor bioavailability due to first pass. So the preferred method is to give it sublingually, which has a peak effect of 3 to 4 hours. Regarding distribution, is pretty lipophilic, so it has extensive distribution and it rapidly penetrates the blood-brain barrier. The volume distribution is 188 to 355 liters after IV administration, and it's 96% protein bound. Regarding metabolism, it's metabolized by CYP3A4. Its active metabolite is norbuprenorphine, which has a half-life, and buprenorphine has a half-life of 38 hours. And lastly, regarding excretion, it is actually eliminated fecally. And less than 20% is renal. So the interesting thing in terms of people who are taking buprenorphine as a medication to treat opioid dependence is that urine drug testing is usually detects norbuprenorphine, so the metabolite of the buprenorphine. So people can't just put the drug into the urine and sell the rest or something like that. So that's pretty interesting fact or characteristic about buprenorphine. Regarding available formulations, as we kind of talked about, there's transdermal, which is really usually used in chronic pain. There's sublingual, which is popular in opioid addiction. There's buccal, which is good for chronic pain. And there's parenteral, which is not used ordinarily. And this is kind of more when if you start doing like acute pain service and they decide to start buprenorphine, generally you start for sublingual, you start with 2 milligrams. But if a patient has a history of use disorder, you may start at 1 milligram. And you kind of titrate up by 2 to 4 milligrams, assuming there's no withdrawal symptoms after 1 to 2 hours of a dose. Because remember, it's a partial agonist, so it's still possible to get withdrawal symptoms. Regarding maintenance, the max dose in a day is 24 milligrams, though most patients respond well to 8 to 12 milligrams a day. Maintenance dose can be determined after about 2 to 4 days, and the frequency could be decreased for stable patients. If you plan on discontinuing buprenorphine, unfortunately, this does take a while, so it may occur over several months to prevent withdrawal. And one thing, say, for example, a patient who's on buprenorphine but comes to the OR for an emergent surgery, the general guideline is to continue buprenorphine through a peri-op period and to maximize multimodal medication. So using ketamine, magnesium, lidocaine, all the other multimodal non-opioid things, because again, it's in the system for a little bit longer. And again, it's a partial agonist, so then there's going to be a ceiling effect in terms of mu opioid activity. And if you're interested in taking a look at a journal article that kind of summarizes the recommendations, I believe it's 2021. It's in the show notes, and I encourage you to take a look at it. All right, so that is it for this part one of the opioid episode, major opioids and pain management, specifically mechanism and major opioids. So hopefully you got something out of that, and hopefully you kind of retain some high yield board points that you can get questions right on your exams. So the next episode, we're going to talk about using opioids in acute pain service. So basically just some general guidelines that I adopted from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute manual, and as well as from some of my experiences rotating on an acute pain service. Okay, that said, the fun fact I have for you today is that beekeepers, they wear white when they're around beehives to help protect themselves. Apparently, bees have learned to be cautious of dark-colored animals that come close to their hives, so wearing white can help them from feeling threatened, which kind of makes sense. All the bee suits you ever seen is they're usually white, and any dark colors like, I don't know, like a brown bear or a black bear or something trying to eat the hive. So I guess that kind of makes sense. So that fun fact is from cracked.com. All right, going to the credits, the major sources for this episode are Benson's Essentials of Pain Medicine, the fourth edition, chapters 42 and 43. The Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Brigham Women's Hospital, Pain Management Tables and Guidelines, 2017 edition, as well as the journal article by Payton and Williams, 2012, Basic Opioid Pharmacology, and lastly, Open Anesthesia, and this article on opioid rotations, echo analgesic dosing. The script and show was produced by me, and intro music was by Brian Teal. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. This is Scott, the anesthesia resident, and I look forward to seeing you in the next episode.